This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan, and I'm an editor at Ahval News, and this is Turkey Abroad. Joining me today is Dr. Aykan Erdemir, who is the senior director of the Turkey program at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Aykan, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you here.
So I want to ask you a few questions about some of the current domestic political turmoil here in the U.S., especially since last week we saw the U.S. Capitol was stormed by a mob of pro-Trump supporters, and they chanted how they wanted to kill the vice president, lawmakers, and ultimately five people ended up dead at the end of it. The president himself was impeached yesterday for inciting an insurrection, according to Congress. And pro-Trump networks of talking heads for years have been engaged in this sort of, they've dabbled in this violent rhetoric that many blame for just setting the fuse to last week's events. So what I want to ask you, though, is how do you think this past week of political turmoil here in the U.S. will affect how the U.S. is perceived, particularly in Turkey right now?
First of all, you know, U.S. around the world, especially during the Cold War, was perceived as basically not only the cradle of democracy, but one of the strongest voices and advocates for democracy and democratization. I think the last 4 years, and particularly the events of the last week, have hurt that image to some extent. And we have seen that in both messages of solidarity as well as messages of maybe skepticism and criticism coming from around the world. And more interestingly, there were a number of governments around the world which were in this Schadenfreude sentiment, you know, whether it's, you know, Iran, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's, interestingly, the Turkish government, we have seen almost joy in the destruction and mayhem that we have all witnessed in the Capitol Hill riots. So this, I think, is an interesting turning point. I think the trends are not yet that clear. But definitely, I think we will continue to see this strong undercurrent of populism. In this instance, it was far-right populism. But we also know that there are also far-left versions of it elsewhere around the world. So populism, I think, is a force to stay. And I think U.S. Has also signaled that. And more importantly, what populism has been feeding on, namely conspiracy theories, prejudices, you know, social media disinformation, as well as state and non-state actor-led disinformation campaigns, are here to stay. So I think that's one important trend. And another important trend is whether the economic inequalities and discontent that has triggered, to some extent, these populist backlashes are here to stay or not. You know, the polarization that's stemming from it is here to stay or not. And as the U.S. tries to grapple with these, I'm sure all around the world, both authoritarian regimes and democracies, are watching very closely to see where the world is heading.
Speaking of polarization, last week, shortly after the riot, I spoke to, here on Turkey Abroad, Dr. Nora Fisher-Onar. She's over at the University of San Francisco, and we were talking about a survey that recently came out gauging Turkey's political polarization. It was conducted by Bilgi University in Istanbul, along with the German Marshall Fund, and it showed that there was very deep levels of polarization on many metrics that were similar to what's discussed here in the U.S., whether it was on economics or just even wanting to be in the same room as somebody with a different opinion or not. What kind of similarities do you think can be drawn between, say, the US and Turkish experience when it comes to polarization?
Now, that's a very important question because there are stark differences as well as striking similarities. But often we fall into the trap of just overlapping these two completely separate systems and set of developments. I know the similarities are very striking and we tend to dwell on them, but also I think very important to highlight the different trends. So on the one hand, yes, both the United States and Turkey happen to be polarized politically. We see it not only in politics, but we also see it in various surveys concerning, you know, attitudes about everyday life issues. The second issue is, yes, there are similar trends of economic discontent. The widening wage gap and some part of the population in both countries feeling that they're almost pushed out of this new global economy that is emerging. So feel that they are the losers in this process. So that will also continue to generate some of these trends. A third striking similarity, of course, is the role of disinformation, the role conspiracy theories, half truths, prejudices, some of the anti-Semitic conspiracies that we have seen, for example, are strikingly similar. It's difficult to imagine that they will just evaporate. So they'll be staying with us in the near time to come. But then let me also then highlight the differences, because on the one hand, we have Turkey, where checks and balances have completely eroded, where there is no separation of powers to talk about, where there is literally one man rule, where Erdogan has amassed executive, legislative, and judicial power, where there is no rule of law or due process, where there is no more private property rights, where all the courts have become basically kangaroo courts, have become executors of Erdogan's show trials and witch hunts. So that is a very darker picture that we have in Turkey. Whereas in the US, I think we have all witnessed almost a stress test for institutions, meaning it's not only institutions and democratic processes that kicked back in, but also, you know, people's, public officials' moral integrity were put to test, and many of them passed with, you know, one could say, flying colors. For example, there were 62 legal challenges about the election results, kind of pushed by the Trump team, and 61 of them were rejected outright, and many of them by judges appointed by Republican administrations, including quite a number of them being appointed by Trump himself. Now, this is in stark contrast to Turkey, where we don't see prosecutors or judges standing up to Erdogan. For example, when we have this sham trial about Osman Kavala or the former show trial concerning Pastor Andrew Brunson, we have seen the entire law enforcement system basically being accomplices in the framing and imprisonment of innocent individuals on completely fabricated allegations. So that is, I think, a big contrast. Plus, again, one other trend that we see here in the United States is that people have crossed party lines. There were 10 Republican representatives who voted to impeach Trump yesterday. Whereas in Turkey, we see that AKP lawmakers, no matter how many times Erdogan has taken U-turns, no matter how egregious his attack on Turkey's democracy, rule of law, and the opposition is, they basically stand with him. And whether it's corruption, whether it's mismanagement, whether it's criminalization of the opposition, we only see these yes men and yes women on the service of Erdogan. So I think that is also important to keep in mind.
You know, that right there, that's also an interesting point on the way in which the AK Party has tended to follow along, even when Erdogan would, as you said, make these U-turns or be alleged to have committed some level of wrongdoing or economic mismanagement. Because I think a lot of Americans might who are paying attention to the news and everything, or analysts, they try to draw some of these parallels between, say, the Republican Party under Donald Trump, and how most of the time, you know, having 10 Republicans vote against him is a pretty significant feat at this point, because there was almost this sense that the party itself would never hold him to account. So would you say that it's fair to say the main difference, say, in this case, whether it's Erdogan and his party or Trump and his party, it's the respect for institutions more so than just the kind of power of that personality that makes the difference?
Now, you know, I think about politics as a kind of a neo-institutionalist. I think institutions matter a lot. And when we talk about institutions, one major misconception is that institutions are simply these legal entities or these organizations. But we often forget that institutions could also mean certain ways of doing things, certain conventions, certain precedents, or it can also mean the human capital, public officials, integrity and stance and ways of, you know, systemic ways of acting, so, and as well as the official discourse and values that enshrine these organizations. So in that sense, of course, the institutions in the United States happen to be much more robust, much more effective compared to Turkey's weak to begin with institutions, which has since been even hollowed out further by the Erdogan government. So, for example, what's strikingly lacking in Turkey over these years has been the absence of kind of moral outcries from within the AKP. You know, even some of Erdogan's former aides, senior aides, who since have broken away from the AKP and established their own parties, they are still quite timid in, you know, targeting Erdogan or criticizing Erdogan. And when they were within the AKP, you know, for almost a decade and a half, they were towing the party line, you know, A to Z, without an exception. So this, I think, is that big striking contrast. You know, the stress test for institutions in the United States wasn't easy, but I would say the institutions survived, and many of the public officials survived this process with at least a passing grade. Whereas in the Turkish case, I think the organizations, the institutions failed, the individuals failed, and moralities failed. Because let's keep in mind that the Republican defection from the Trump camp or from the populist camp is not just the 10 representatives who voted to impeach him yesterday. It's also significant numbers of the Republican political elite, not just during the last election, but going all the way back to the 2016 election, voicing their dissent, declaring their support to vote for either another candidate, either the Democratic candidate or a third candidate, or simply voicing their opposition to Trump's candidacy. This shows that in the U.S. system, of course, which is very decentralized, you know, not just in terms of, you know, federalism and, you know, the states, but also in terms of the political parties being these kind of big tent umbrellas with a high level of heterogeneity, where elected officials are highly responsive to their local dynamics and electoral demands. Now compare that with Turkey, where political parties, for both historical reasons going back to the 1980 coup d'etat and its political parties law, and also for reasons of broader political culture, happened to be extremely hierarchical, you know, happened to be leadership driven, happened to be extremely quote-unquote disciplined in the militaristic sense, that dissent in Turkish political parties, especially in the AKP, is frowned upon. And just let me throw in a striking detail here. It's only of all the political parties that exist today, it's only the Republican People's Party, the CHP, where you see multiple candidates for party leadership in party conventions, and where we have seen some close races, not just over the last decade, but for quite some time. You know, going back to the 70s, 90s, we have repeatedly seen these instances of multiple contenders having these fierce competitions and close calls in, you know, intra-party elections. But we don't see that pretty much anywhere else in the Turkish political system. And that, I think, is a sign that there is something horridly wrong about the Turkish political system.
Going into the CHP for a moment, actually, because last week I reported on an set of statements that were being made in the Turkish press where members or supporters of the Turkish ruling coalition of MHP or AKP, they're actually using the U.S.'s political problems last week, particularly the riot, as a way to actually tar their opponents, especially the CHP's leader. And I wanted to ask, what do you make of it? Does it surprise you really that the U.S.'s political problems are now being used to sort of shame the Turkish political opposition, and they're just trying to have almost like a guilt by association?
Now, this is, of course, not at all surprising, because we have seen over the years two striking trends when it comes to how the AKP has been undermining Turkey's democracy. The first one is en masse criminalization of Turkey's entire opposition parties. And second, also the entire dissident field. This includes academics, journalists, public intellectuals, and NGOs. So the AKP-MHP coalition, the ruling bloc, this Islamist ultra-nationalist bloc, mainly works through criminalizing, harassing, intimidating, and then imprisoning their political adversaries. And this, of course, is something we are extremely familiar with from other authoritarian regimes. The second dynamic is often the framing of the opposition, of dissident voices, as fifth columns, as traitors, by associating with them, with foreign powers, who are then, you know, framed as adversaries, you know, or working with Turkey's adversaries. And this, again, is really an authoritarian tactic used by the AKP-MHP bloc. But at the same time, let's never underestimate that this is not just solely about holding on to power in Turkey. This is not just an attempt to, you know, find a pretext to undermine the opposition. This is also a strong sentiment of solidarity between Turkey's ruling bloc and the far-right populists in the United States. I know it comes as quite, difficult to grasp, especially for our American audiences, because they're thinking, how could an Islamist party in Turkey have so much in common with far-right populists who are racist, who have a strong anti-Muslim sentiment, and who could be as anti-Turkish as any other far-right movement, in the European Union? And that is the striking thing, that although they come from very different parts of the world, from very different cultural spheres, there is actually a great common denominator that unites populist far-right extremists around the world. So this is their common pedigree. It's almost as if there is now a far-right international, a populist international in the making. And it was no surprise to me when I saw the Turkish foreign ministry and some Turkish officials express Schadenfreude when they were making fun of the riots in the US, where they were literally equidistant to democratic institutions attacked and the mobs, the rioters who are resorting to violence. And it was no surprise to me when in pro-government media, we have seen some of the worst anti-Semitic conspiracies peddled by some leading columnists and echoing some of the messaging coming from the Capitol Hill rioters, you know. So when it comes to Holocaust denial or when it comes to conspiracies about, you know, a Jewish cabal ruling the world, the rioters in the Capitol Hill and Erdogan's foot soldiers are actually very much the same. So they come from similar global far-right conspiratorial populist roots. So if you put them in the same room, they might not be fond of one another, given the cultural, linguistic, religious divide. But ultimately, they are actually siblings of the same parentage. And of course, this goes all the way back to, you know, dark days of the European history when we have seen far-right, you know, wreak havoc in not only in Europe, but in the world. So now I think we should really watch with concern as Erdogan's political movement in Turkey, ruling bloc in Turkey, echoes in extremely worrisome ways these dark elements on the fringe right of the Republican Party.
And of course, you know, this is much easier to sort of exchange information now with social media and the kind of disinformation that goes on there. I doubt that there's going to be much direct exchange between the two sides, considering I doubt, you know, the majority of Americans for that matter, they won't be able to find it easy to probably communicate with their Turkish counterparts. And so, like you said, for whether it's linguistic or cultural reasons, but those tropes do seem to endure, like, yeah. Of course, the anti-Semitic ones, or in some cases, the racist ones as well. And it seems that, you know, this union is just the foundation of it is essentially on like this idea that, okay, it's authoritarianism on our terms, like almost like what they talk about in, say, of course, in Central and Eastern Europe, the illiberal regimes that you see over there.
Definitely. And thank you for bringing in also Central and Eastern Europe, because I think ultimately, if we reduce these trends that we see today simply down to a few leaders with authoritarian tendencies, we would be misleading us. So first of all, it's, I think, important to recognize that we're talking about a new political, cultural, social climate that is globally pervasive. And as you said, tropes are shared across, whether it's, for example, skepticism about vaccines, whether it's conspiratorial explanations about COVID-19, whether it's anti-Semitism, whether it's racism, whether it's, let's say, a disdain of expertise and education and cultural and political elite. These are very much global phenomena. So they might be manifested under different cultural, religious, political cloaks, but ultimately they stem from the same place and they really feed from one another. They reinforce one another. But second, of course, this is not just about conspiracies, delusional thinking, or some political brokers, authoritarian political brokers, because this is also a very important political economic phenomenon. If you look the other way and ignore what socioeconomic undercurrents have exacerbated or led to and exacerbated these problems, again, I think we would be misleading us because when you take a look at what's happening globally is that, yes, globalism has been a net contributor to the increase of per capita income around the world, to eradication of absolute poverty to some extent. But at the same time, there has been a great divide between the winners and losers as well. Meaning, although overall globalization has been a positive trend for the world economy at large, the benefits accrued very differently to different segments of the population. And I won't go into the macroeconomic indicators, but I think one sentiment that explains this economic phenomenon best is this. Around the world, in opinion polls, current generation of parents believe and feel that their children will be worse off than them. Now, this is striking because especially in the West, you know, one big success story has been, you know, upward mobility or each generation having better living conditions than the previous one. So that really kept the system going and reinforced faith in democracy and pluralism. But now if we are at an inflection point where we believe the next generation will be worse off and the one after that will be even worse off, meaning they will have much less, not only disposable income, but have access to public goods. I think that is a scary thought, not just for the world, but that is also ammunition for far right and far left populists to exploit.
You know, in order to push back on this kind of on this trend, so to speak, you know, it would require probably the U.S. to re-engage a lot more on human rights advocacy, and you know, it does seem that, of course, in the last 4 years, the U.S. has scaled back some of its rhetoric on human rights, and it's been challenged during the Trump years by out of rivals using actions done at home, and on top of that too. You know, we haven't had as much of a consistent voice on human rights advocacy in other countries, particularly like in Turkey. One analyst that I know, you know, they even joke that in terms of human rights advocacy, Sedat Kilic here in the U.S. has probably spoken up more about what he sees as human rights abuses than the U.S. ambassador right now in Ankara has. Of course, he was making that as a joke, but I think it's you know, it's striking that, you know, feel like it's at that point. But I want to ask you is, would you say that these last 4 years of really downplaying human rights concerns on top of, you know, domestic discord at home, has that significantly challenged our ability in the U.S. to really speak up for human rights around the world, or at least in Turkey?
First, let me start by saying that I definitely agree that human rights was pushed back in American foreign policy agenda. And I think this was really unfortunate. And I also have to add a footnote here. There is one exception. When it comes to advocacy for freedom of religion or belief, we have seen a robust advocacy on the part of the Trump government. And we have also seen some positive results. We have seen how globally there has been some really move toward recognizing and promoting greater freedom of religion or belief, which itself should be an important message. It shows that America's moral leadership matters, that it can have an impact. Meaning, if the U.S. advocacy was not just limited to the freedom of religion or belief around the world, but also to human rights in general, then I think the obvious conclusion is that would have also made a huge difference. In fact, even since the election of Biden, you know, as president-elect, we have seen a radical course correction around the world, as many authoritarian governments have taken steps in preparation for the incoming Biden administration, because this is almost like a pecking order. They didn't want to be the worst. They wanted to at least do slightly better than the authoritarian regime next door, so that they wouldn't be receiving, you know, the Biden administration's main criticism. So this shows that not just for the U.S., but also for the European Union, they have enormous leverage and potential to promote human rights, democracy, and pluralism. They often undermine their capacity. They often undermine their influence. They, I think, have a striking lack of realization how plastic, how flexible, especially the authoritarian regimes are, how in their bid for survival, they're actually willing to reform, maybe for the wrong reasons, but nevertheless, take some steps to improve the human rights situation there. So overall, I think this is what the Biden administration should be focused on. I know he is he has already expressed interest in bringing together kind of democracies as part of this democratic alliance. That is, I think, a very important step. But there, the key suggestion I would have, key policy suggestion I would have is to make sure this is not just a gathering of democratic governments, but also this is an open invitation to all the pro-democracy activists suffering in authoritarian regimes like Turkey and building and strengthening solidarity ties with all those voices for pluralism and human rights. Mm-hmm.
You already jumped ahead to answering the question I had next, actually. But since Joe Biden's going to be coming in less than a week to office, his administration's going to arrive with, you know, potentially a complicated set of tasks between COVID-19, possibly still the impeachment trial, and having to just set up the roots for, you know, the government to function for the next 4 years. And I want to ask you, and you, again, you already kind of answered this already, but how the Biden administration, amidst all this, can best find a way to focus on, you know, human rights advocacy, especially in Turkey.
Now, let me expand on my earlier comments. First of all, yes, it's very important for the U.S. government to signal clearly, express clearly that human rights is a core U.S. concern. And U.S. will be back robustly in promoting human rights, democracy, and pluralism. I know there will be challenges after the Capitol riots, but I think Washington can use that still as kind of a talking point, as a leverage, because ultimately this is not just a one-way relationship. This is more like let's do it together, meaning democracy promotion, human rights promotion, as a process that accrues benefits to all the parties involved, including the United States. Second, the natural conclusion is that this has to be a significant transatlantic enterprise. I think it's very important to end the neo-isolationist sentiment that has taken hold of both the American right and the left. It's important for the U.S. to re-engage with the world, but more importantly, re-engage the world with its transatlantic partners. You know, I think a strong emphasis on NATO is necessary, because NATO is not just a military alliance, but also a political alliance. So pushing back against Russian, Chinese, you know, Iranian, Venezuelan, or Turkish authoritarianism actually requires not just security measures, but they also require political measures. And if we move this a step forward, and because I'm already seeing some debate about, you know, reversing the trend during the Trump era, when there was a strong emphasis on freedom of religion or belief, but not on human rights. And now there are some concerns that there will be strong emphasis on human rights, but not on religious freedom of religion or belief. So it's very important, I think, for the Biden administration to end this false dichotomy. You know, human rights regime, pluralism, is just one big package. You know, you can't really compartmentalize it. You can't have human rights. You can't have pluralism if you leave out freedom of religion or belief. And it's very important to note that that also includes the right not to believe, the right not to practice, the right to be an agnostic, an atheist, the right to be a convert, to right to leave a religion. So this is not just an agenda for religious individuals. This is basically for peoples of all walks of life, all faiths or disbeliefs. So it's very important for the Biden administration to, I think, overcome these divisions in the human rights field and combine a robust advocacy for, you know, democracy, pluralism, gender rights, freedom of religion or belief, and struggle against all sorts of hate and prejudice, including anti-Semitism, anti-Christian sentiment, anti-Muslim sentiment, you know, homophobia, transphobia, you know, these hateful ideologies are very important kind of recruitment tools to mobilize discontented publics into these, you know, far-right populist movements. So it's also very important to tackle them at their, you know, at the level of their root ideology and values and conspiracies.
Icon, this has been a great conversation, and I really do hate to end it too soon, but I really hope that you can also come back on Turkey Abroad sometime soon, and we'll continue from there.
It will be my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.